This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In 1980, the southern African nation of Zimbabwe emerged after years of struggle against a minority white regime. The hero of the movement, Robert Mugabe, was hailed as a liberator and elected president. And for many years, Zimbabwe enjoyed political and economic stability and good relations with its white minority population, most of whom were farmers. Yet today, Zimbabwe is in crisis. Economic activity is almost at a standstill. The rate of inflation is so high it's hard to measure, and prices for what few goods are available can change twice a day. There are severe shortages of fuel and electricity. By some estimates, a quarter of the country's population is now refugees. The economic instability has increased political tension, and President Mugabe's government is accused of torture and rape and a crackdown on the opposition. How did it get so bad? What's to be done now? And why are some of Zimbabwe's neighbors, particularly South Africa, so reluctant to criticize? Our guests include Zimbabwe's ambassador to the United States and an author and activist who participated in the liberation struggle, who now describes the ruling party as an instrument of evil. Later in the program, a new intelligence assessment reports that Al-Qaeda is now stronger than it's been since 9/11. But first, Zimbabwe. If you have questions about the current crisis, particularly if you've been to that country or have family there, give us a call. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Peeta Thornycroft. She's Zimbabwe correspondent for the British newspaper The Daily Telegraph. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And how bad is the economic situation inside Zimbabwe? For example, how bad is inflation right now?
Official inflation statistics are about nearly 5,000% per annum, which is the highest in the world. Many retailers say it's much higher than that. It's probably double that. And so the government recently, 10 days ago, slashed the prices of many consumer goods to the level they were on the 18th of June. This has led to a run on basic essentials in the supermarkets and empty shelves in many supermarkets.
So do people, when they get a paycheck or get some money, tend to spend it right away?
Yes. There's 80% unemployment in the formal sector, so Zimbabwe's largely become an informal trading country, and people are desperate. Nobody can live with that kind of inflation. It's actually unconscionable, and one cannot describe it unless you actually live with going to a supermarket and then checking out the basic minimums you need and noticing that two or three days later they've gone up again. And this, of course, is because Zimbabwe's productivity has slumped. It has no foreign currency. Its manufacturing sector has is half what it was in 2000. It can't feed itself. Its health services collapsed. The education sector is on its knees. It is a very depressing country, and it's a very sad story for the majority of the population.
As we think about this economic crisis, what about electricity? What about fuel?
People go without electricity for two or three days at a time. The average cuts are between 5 and 17 hours a day. Zimbabwe used to be able to generate all its own electricity, but it can no longer do that because its facilities have fallen into disrepair, and it doesn't have the foreign currency to pay for enough electricity from the Democratic Republic of Congo or South Africa. Fuel is all imported, of course. Zimbabwe does not have oil. At the moment, fuel is very scarce because the government cut the price of fuel to 50% below the cost of delivered fuel. So it's extremely scarce, and commuters are now stranded because the commuter fares have been cut by half. And so this is gathering momentum at the moment as the country really does begin to wind down.
Many Zimbabweans have reportedly fled to South Africa to escape the kind of situation you're describing. How has President Mbeki in South Africa responded to this?
For the first few years of this crisis, he did not criticize his next-door neighbor at all. In fact, in 2002, during the presidential election, the election observer team had decided ahead of the elections that those polls were legitimate and credible when clearly and patently there was evidence that they were not. They were extremely violent elections. He has since then tried bits and pieces. 2 years ago, he offered a $1 billion loan to Zimbabwe with political strings attached, and that was turned down by President Mugabe. Now he is trying to facilitate mediation between the ruling ZANU-PF and the opposition, the Movement for Democratic Change. Last weekend, the ZANU-PF delegates to the mediation talks didn't show up, and that was interpreted in South Africa as a snub to Mbeki. I suppose Zimbabweans feel really embittered that their next-door neighbor, President Mbeki, has done so little to publicly criticize the gross human rights abuses taking place and the incredible impoverishment of one of Africa's most prosperous societies until the last few years.
You mentioned the opposition and, of course, the ruling party, ZANU-PF. Is Zimbabwe effectively a one-party state?
On paper, no, because there are 41 opposition members of parliament sitting in parliament, but parliament doesn't do anything. The opposition cannot hold rallies in Harare or in the second city, Bulawayo. Those rallies are banned 3 months at a time. If they do want to have a rally outside that area, they have to seek police permission under very tough security laws. They've beaten the opposition to a pulp following the dreadful torture in police custody of Morgan Tsvangirai, who is the founding president of the MDC, and scores of his colleagues. They then went into people's houses in the high-density suburbs around Harare and were beating people up. Between 4 and 12 people were turning up for treatment by doctors every single day for about 7 weeks after that. And that is all documented by medical practitioners and human rights activists. It's almost impossible for an opposition party now or in the 1980s to stand up against President Mugabe and ZANU-PF.
And is there, from your vantage point, any solution in sight? Is the South African attempt to mediate, does that look prospective? Hello? Well, evidently we've lost our line to Peta Thornycroft, the Zimbabwe correspondent of the British Daily Telegraph, but we thank her for her time today. Joining us now in Studio 3A here in Washington is Machiven Yikamapuranga. I hope I'm pronouncing that not too badly. He's Zimbabwe's ambassador to the United States. Mr. Ambassador, thanks very much for taking the time to join us today. We appreciate your being with us.
You're welcome.
And this economic crisis, first of all, what's the origin of it and what steps is the government taking to address it?
Right. You mentioned that there was no desire on the part of South Africa to criticize Zimbabwe. But let me put it to you that, in fact, South Africa, together with the regional body of Southern African states known as SADC, this Southern African Development Community, they actually go much further than you are talking about. They express solidarity with the people, with the government and people of Zimbabwe. They did this on the 28th of March when they met when the heads of state and government met in Dar es Salaam. And there's another regional body that that Zimbabwe belongs to. It's known as COMESA, Community for Southern and Eastern African Countries. 19 countries. They met in Nairobi and they expressed solidarity with the government and people of Zimbabwe. In fact, they chose President Mugabe as the vice president of COMESA, the president being the host country, President Mwai Kibaki, and decided that next year the summit will be held in Harare. What greater solidarity, act of solidarity can you talk about? And you, as you know, only a few weeks ago, Zimbabwe was elected chairman of the United Nations Commission on sustainable development in face of fierce opposition from the British and their allies. And lastly, you know that we have this annual consultation conference between the African Union and the European Union. The British had prevailed on their allies in the European Union to say we should not meet if Zimbabwe is there. But their suggestion was was turned down. And this summit is going to take place in November in Portugal with Zimbabwe present. Now, I'm just saying all these things to show you that the rest of the world has solidarity with the government and people of Zimbabwe. This is because we are a very democratic country. Democratic not just in the sense of having free speech and separation of powers and so forth, but democratic in the sense that we would want the vast majority of the people of the country to enjoy the natural resources of their country, particularly land, the minerals, and so forth. And that's where the Zimbabwe's problems started, when we decided that the time had come for the land to be redistributed equitably on a non-racial basis to the people of Zimbabwe. We had inherited a situation, untenable racist situation, where 75% of the land belonged to white farmers, and Africans had been herded into native reserves. Yeah, because Zimbabwe, like South Africa, if you read the Colonial Office documents, they were termed white men's country, along with Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. So basically, when we redistributed land, the British imposed sanctions against us, and they prevailed on their allies in the European Union and North America to impose sanctions against us as a punishment for this land reform program. And this is why our economy is has been on a downward spiral.
And we have
since
to,
then.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back, Mr. Ambassador. This is NPR News. Right now, our focus is on Zimbabwe. The country's economy is in free fall. A carton of juice can cost more than $500,000 Zimbabwe dollars, and that's if you can find one. The huge rate of inflation is leading to political tensions and to violence in some areas. Millions of refugees have fled the country already. How did this happen? What can be done about it? Our guest is the Zimbabwean ambassador to the United States, Ambassador Mapuranga. And if you have questions, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. You can also check out our blog, npr.org. At npr.org/blog of the nation. Here's an email we got from David in Bluffton, South Carolina. I was born in Zimbabwe and left in 1982 with my parents and brother. We left a lot of family there. Last year, we finally managed to convince my grandparents to leave and move to South Africa with my parents. The problem was selling their house. The money they receive for it is now not worth anything, and it's just about impossible to get foreign currency out of Zimbabwe. It's a shame for people my grandparents' age not to have any money for retirement. Scary. It used to be such a great country, and now it's just a ruin. Very sad. The economic crisis, the political crisis in Zimbabwe, Mr. Ambassador, this was, as was described, once one of the most prosperous countries in Africa.
Yes, but, it was prosperous. It was heaven for the white men, not for the black men, because Africans did not own land. And we, when it came to other natural resources, such as minerals, the vast mineral resources that we have, all the minerals, all the mines belong to white companies, and Africans were just laborers there. So you see, it's true, it was heaven for the Rhodesians, but for the indigenous people, it was hell.
It's not been Rhodesia since 1980.
Yes, but this is why we had to fight a liberation war for 14 years. And when we got our independence in 1980, it was as a result of a peace conference at Lancaster House, where
in London,
and where it was agreed that this situation is untenable, and the land had to be redistributed on an equal basis. And the British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher had agreed that she would fund the land reform program so that the landless blacks also have land. But when, as you know, her party was defeated in the 1997 elections, the new government of Tony Blair reneged on that. And they said, we are not beholden to promises made by the Conservative Party. And when we proceeded to pass legislation and to amend our constitution to enable the government to legally and forcibly acquire land for redistribution to landless black people, the British government imposed sanctions and prevailed on their neighbors in Europe and North America to impose sanctions against our country, to hurt the economy in the hope that a damaged economy would make the people rise against their government. And the outgoing Prime Minister of Britain made no bones about it. He proclaimed to the House of Commons that his government's policy was that of regime change. And the government here in the United States have come out recently to say that they are working with the opposition for the downfall of the elected government of Zimbabwe. So these economic sanctions that are hurting our economy are the bane of Zimbabwe. And we would want those who say the economic sanctions are not the root of our problems to remove those sanctions and see whether our economy will not bounce back.
Let's get a caller on the line. And this is Chris. Chris joins us from Kansas.
Hello?
Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay, I'm sorry. Mr. Ambassador, you're very good at obfuscating the facts on this. My father's farm was taken in Zimbabwe, and I've gone back to visit it a number of times. A commercial farm that supported 2,000 people, 2,000 to 3,000 people, now supports 200 families who can barely make ends meet. You know, a country that could feed itself in the 1980s and 1990s now has to import food. And most of that land that you took away from the farmers has been given to the cronies of the government, government ministers and all sorts of people who can you explain this? Why have government ministers got 3 and 4 farms? Why have, you know, members of the army, people like Rex Nongo, all those sort of people got 4 and 5 different farms? That doesn't seem to be land redistribution in my eyes.
Mr. Ambassador?
Yes. The land reform program that has been effected in Zimbabwe has actually two programs. You have what is known as A1, and this is a program to give land to the landless peasantry. And as we speak now, more than 100,000 families have been given land. They have benefited from the land reform program. These are not cronies.
But haven't government ministers and party officials gotten prime land?
And then the other program, known as A2, that is to let Africans get into the commercial farming area, which used to be the preserve of the white man. Now, we are talking of 40,000 new black farmers under this program. How can you have 40,000 cronies? And talking about ministers and so forth, of course, how many ministers do we have? We don't have more than 30 ministers. So 30 out of 40,000. You can't say the land was given to cronies. In the United States here, the people do, even the president has a ranch, and his ministers, they have ranches. So why should Zimbabwean ministers not have land? This is totally flabbergasting to me.
You've talked about, we're just going to ask you one more question and then and move on to another guest, but you've talked about lifting economic sanctions imposed from the outside as the source of your difficulties. There is also the crackdown on the opposition. Mr. Tsvangirai has been beaten several times and jailed. Is this tolerable? Is this a democracy?
Yes. You know, since independence, we have had parliamentary elections every 5 years, religiously, without fail. And these elections have been observed by Africa's continental body, the Organization of African Unity, OAU, now known as the African Union. And invariably, they have validated those elections. And so we had no problem with opposition parties until the MDC, the main opposition party now, which is two...
Movement for Democratic Change.
Yes, which has split into two.
Yes.
Working with Tony Blair, who declared that his policy towards Zimbabwe is regime change, and through the Westminster Foundation and the so-called Zimbabwe Democracy Trust, have been pouring in money, funding the opposition. And when the opposition started to say, we are going for a final push. We are not going to get power through elections, but through street demonstrations and rallies and violence. That's when the government, no government worth its salt would fold its arms when 11 police stations were burnt down by the opposition, and policemen were hospitalized, buses were burned down, and other private property. Now, the moment they resorted to violence and terrorism, the government had to act.
Machiva Nyika-Mapuranga, Zimbabwe's ambassador to the United States, joined us here in Studio 3A. Thank you very much for your time, sir. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Joining us now is Judith Todd, a human rights activist, author of the book Through the Darkness, A Life in Zimbabwe. She joins us today by phone from Cape Town in South Africa, and it's good to have you on the program today.
Thank you so much.
You were, if you would inform us, you were among those who was involved in the liberation struggle yourself.
Yes, and I still am. But we just have new oppressors now.
New oppressors? Would that be President Mugabe and the ZANU-PF?
Indeed. You know, just before the 1980 elections, one of the members of President Mugabe's clan, Aaron Mutiti, said, unless the people of this country are vigilant, they are in for a rude shock. Family life, religious life, and economic life as we know it will progressively disappear if Mugabe gets to power. We must not close our eyes to this threat. He rates his communist ideology higher than people. And so for the last 27 years, we've been watching what Mr. Mutiti said come true. Family life, religious life, and economic life as we know it is progressively disappearing.
You, I'm sure, heard the ambassador say that the embargo imposed by Britain and its allies is responsible for the economic problems in South Africa. Is that the problem in your view?
Not at all. To start off with, there's no embargo at all. There are travel sanctions on some of the top criminals in Mugabe's regime. There are no sanctions against Zimbabwe. When I say criminals, in the pattern of destroying opposition, Mugabe and his vehicle of evil, ZANU-PF, started in the 1980s with their Five Brigade, wiping out any formal black opposition with Gukuru Hundi, troops moving through Matabeleland and the Midlands, killing, raping, murdering. That was the 1980s. Then from 2000 came the destruction of commercial farming and thus the bedrock of the economy. From 2005, they attempted the destruction of the informal sector under Operation Murambatsvina, which meant people going through the high-density suburbs in cities like Harare, Bulawayo, destroying the homes and the livelihoods of hundreds of thousands of black people. Now what we are seeing is the destruction of commerce and industry and the looting of what is left of the economy by his supporters. Zimbabwe is dying in front of the eyes of the world at this moment.
Yet, as you know, the government and its supporters claim that a lot of the things that you're describing were necessary to erase the vestiges of colonialism.
I don't think the wholesale slaughter of fellow black Zimbabweans has anything to do with colonialism. This is crushing present or potential opposition by lawless means, by, as I say, killing and destruction, and that's what's happening today. There are hardly any whites left in the country.
We're talking with Judith Todd, a human rights activist and author, about the situation in Zimbabwe today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I should point out, I think you were stripped of your Zimbabwean citizenship in 2003?
I was, and I was a born Zimbabwean. And I spent my life fighting for one man, one vote, and for equality of citizenship. But I was only one of hundreds of thousands, the vast majority of whom were black, were stripped of their citizenship because it was thought we might vote against the Mugabe regime.
We're speaking to you today from Cape Town in South Africa. That is, as I understand it, because you're launching your book there, and you still live in Bulawayo in Zimbabwe?
I live in Bulawayo. I have a visa to visit South Africa for 3 months. I've been here for 2 months, and my book was launched last Thursday.
And you plan to go back?
Oh, certainly. It's my home.
As you think about the future of your country, what is it that you think can break the current crisis that has people so desperate?
There's only one solution, and that is the physical removal from the scene of President Mugabe. He's running out of options. He's terrified of ending up in the criminal court at The Hague, and he's now pulling down the temples of the pillar. If time is running out for him, he's demonstrating to the rest of his countrymen that time is running out for them, and he will destroy their country and them before he leaves power.
If the situation is that bad, we heard the ambassador describe any number of diplomatic organizations which have honored Zimbabwe of late by electing them to various representative offices. Why are Zimbabwe's neighbors apparently not have the same opinion?
It's very strange, and I've just been reading actually today in the South African press how ashamed many of the people are here of the complicity, apparent complicity, of the South African government through their policy of quiet diplomacy in crimes against the people of Zimbabwe. For example, there's a massive swell of refugees coming from Zimbabwe into South Africa, people fleeing for their lives. Many of them are put into detention centers here, and are then put onto deportation trains, about 4,000 per day, and sent back into the furnace. This can't continue because, I mean, people now at home have nothing to eat in the rural and urban areas. And even Mugabe's supporters, who are at present looting what is left, will soon have nothing to eat. And practically the whole country will be flooding over the border into South Africa. So South Africa at last will have to do something. But nothing can be done without the removal of President Mugabe.
And that sounds awkward to call for, as the ambassador would have put it, regime change.
It doesn't sound at all awkward. If there is to be any life preserved in Zimbabwe, that regime must be changed before the whole country is a cemetery.
Judith Todd, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Judith Todd, a human rights activist and author of the book Through the Darkness, A Life in Zimbabwe. She joined us today by phone from Cape Town in South Africa. When we come back, coming up, gut feelings and the new intelligence report that says Al-Qaeda is a bigger threat than at any time since September the 11th. Plus, something unusual happened at this morning's presidential news conference. We'll talk about it next. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.